the longer we put this off, the longer we stay in this period of deficit spending and whatnot. So that's a concern I have.
Governor Walker weighs in on the new oil and gas tax bill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska Republicans head to Fairbanks for the state convention.
The statewide Trump people have been doing a lot of stuff through social media, talking to people.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The types of oil and gas companies that would benefit from state tax credits would change under a bill the House Rules Committee unveiled yesterday. Governor Bill Walker says he's concerned about these changes. The bill also received a cool reception from industry, but it may be the best chance to resolve one of the thorniest issues facing the state. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Governor Walker says he likes that there's been movement in the legislature on oil and gas taxes, but he's concerned about some of the bill's contents.
You know, we don't want to be in a situation where we're pitting one, you know, producers against the independents, those that are coming in on the exploration side.
The bill would phase out a type of tax credit based on net operating losses. In addition, the bill scales back oil and gas tax credits at a slower pace than Walker has proposed.
The longer we put this off, the longer we stay in this period of deficit spending and whatnot. So that's a concern I have.
While Walker would like to see the tax credit scaled back quicker, that doesn't mean the bill satisfies industry's concerns. Alaska Oil and Gas Association President and CEO Kara Moriarty says scaling back tax credits will discourage oil and gas companies from investing in the state.
If the state of Alaska changes the policy, we will respond accordingly.
Moriarty has said that an earlier version of the bill would particularly harm investment in Cook Inlet. The new version also would eliminate tax credits in Cook Inlet, but at a slower pace than the Senate bill, which Moriarty described as a nuclear bomb.
The House Rules version, it's still a bomb, may not be nuclear, if you will.
Oil and gas industry expert Larry Persily says the criticism coming from both Walker and the industry reflects the issue's contentiousness. Persily is an advisor to Kenai Peninsula Borough.
There's clearly an attempt to try to find enough votes because there's not enough votes for any plan at the moment. And clearly not enough votes for this one either.
The governor's bill would save the state up to $720 million more than the House Rules version over the next 2 years. Walker says that if the oil and gas tax bill doesn't include these savings, the state would have to come up with the savings somewhere else. Persily says the differences over the oil and gas tax issue are predictable.
Getting into oil taxes, whether it's credits or tax rates or minimums or deductions, you know, that is the big battle in Alaska.
Walker's fiscal plan and the current bills either passed or being considered by the legislature are nearly $1 billion apart this year. Considering the governor and the legislature's majorities remain far apart on an income tax and other tax increases, it doesn't look like the session will end anytime soon. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
If Donald Trump doesn't have the presidential nomination in the bag by July, the Republican National Convention could be the most exciting in decades. 28 Alaskans get to participate, and this week, Alaska Republicans will choose who gets to go. APRN's Liz Ruskin looks at what's ahead for the state convention in Fairbanks, which runs tomorrow through Saturday, and beyond that at the Big Show in Cleveland.
Republicans don't want any trouble from the fire marshal when they gather at the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel. State Party Communications Director Suzanne Downing says they already have 400 people registered and paid, so they're nearly at room capacity already. And Downing says people are excited.
That's the thing that I'm getting from most people that are going to the state convention. They feel like they're part of history. They feel like they're part of creating America.
The convention will pick a new state party chair and decide the party platform. But the big buzz now is about which Alaskans will be delegates to Cleveland in July. The Fairbanks Convention will choose 12 delegates for Ted Cruz, 11 for Trump, and 5 for Marco Rubio. Rubio suspended his campaign but asked to retain the 5 delegates he won in Alaska on Super Tuesday. Downing says more than 150 Alaskans have applied to fill those spots at the National Convention, and they're lobbying hard. At the same time, the presidential campaigns are scrambling to vet the potential delegates. Or Downing says the Cruz campaign is.
Oh, yeah. The Cruz campaign has been very active, and they've been scouring the delegate sheets for the people who want to represent Cruz at national convention. And then the national Cruz campaign has been calling each of those delegates and interviewing them and seeing what their true interest is in him as a candidate, because they really want to find people who are true blue Cruz supporters.
The Trump campaign, not so much, Downing says.
We haven't actually had very much contact from the Trump campaign. We haven't seen them in the office.
But Anchorage Trump campaign volunteer David Morgan says Trump is active in Alaska. Morgan says he's helping party stalwart Jim Crawford and former state senator Jerry Ward as they mull who'd make the best Trump delegates.
In real truth, the the statewide Trump people have been doing a lot of stuff through social media, talking to people, but not just in the last 2 weeks have we actually been getting active in a more traditional sense on the ground.
All Alaska delegates in Cleveland will be bound to their candidate for at least 2 rounds of balloting before they become free agents. That's per Republican Party rules adopted a few elections ago, when Randy Reidrick was party chairman.
At the end of the second round, the lowest vote getter would be released. And at the end of the third round, the next lowest. So for all Alaska delegates to be released, it might take 5 rounds of voting.
Reidrick says he helped write the delegate binding rules to encourage more Alaska Republicans to the polls on Super Tuesday. And he says they work by giving voters a direct tie to the national nomination process. But as bound delegates, the Alaskans are unlikely to be showered with attention in Cleveland, the way it's rumored unbound delegates from other states will be treated. Regardless, if you're a political junkie, a national convention is the place to be. Morgan, the Trump supporter, has been to a few conventions, and he says the opportunities to mix and mingle are fantastic.
From former presidents, secretaries of state, major key individuals you see on Fox News or on Morning Joe, they'll be there and they'll be walking around and talking to people.
Morgan has a tip for people vying for a spot. Aim to be one of the 25 alternates. Like the regular delegates, you have to pay your own way to Cleveland. But Morgan says you'll have more fun and more freedom.
And you can socialize and you can go up and look at booths and, you know, buy a stuffed elephant or whatever. It's just kind of cool.
3 of Alaska's delegates to Cleveland are already chosen because they hold party offices. They are Ralph Seekins, Cynthia Henry, and outgoing party chairman Peter Goldberg. That leaves just 25 delegate spots to fill and a lot of people hoping to get one. For APRN, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, is the warm water blob affecting salmon runs in southeast?
We predicted a fairly good pink salmon return to southeast Alaska, and I kind of have to face the music here. We didn't get that strong return.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
A plane crash near Anchorage that killed all 4 on board last week was engaged in aerial photography over Birchwood at the time of the accident. The National Transportation Safety Board today released the first of three reports on the incident. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
According to the report, the Cessna 172, piloted by George Kobelnik, was flying under visual flight rules about 2 miles from the Birchwood Airport in good weather at the time of the accident. Visibility was 9 miles, with calm winds and cloud cover at 8,000 feet. The purpose of the flight was an aerial survey of land adjacent to the airport, and FAA radar data indicates the plane was flying low, making several turns near the edge of the airport's property before it crashed. Sean Williams led the investigation on the day of the crash. He says the plane was making basic maneuvers and not doing anything inherently dangerous.
We're still evaluating everything at this time. We're still in the early phases of the investigation. That's just stating what the weather was at the time. But we're still going to go back and look at the winds and see what effects maybe the cloud layer had on visibility or anything like that.
Investigators say the plane lifted off from the Birchwood Airport, achieved a height of about 1,800 feet, and then made a 360-degree turn before continuing along the shoreline of Kinnick Arm. Several more turns were made. Then the plane again flew back over the Kinnick Arm shoreline, turned again, ascended to 1,100 feet, and then back down to 800 feet. That is the last position recorded by radar data. The preliminary report indicates the plane initially hit a 100-foot-tall spruce tree, then left a trail of wreckage almost 500 feet long. Fragments of the plane, including parts of the landing gear, were strewn along the debris field. All the plane's main components were found at the main debris site, but a fire on impact consumed much of the wreckage. Williams says a second, more factual report will follow the preliminary report, and a third report indicating probable cause will follow in about a year.
We look at three main areas in any investigation: the man, the machine, and the environment. By man, we look at the pilot, we look at his history, his training, 72 hours for fatigue or anything like that, stressors, anything. By machine, we're going to look at the airplane. We're going to go back through all the maintenance records and see how it was maintained and what work was done on it. And the environment is where we're going to look at the weather and any conditions, air traffic, anything that could have affected the flight.
Pilot George Kobelnik, age 64, was killed in the crash, along with passengers Christian Bohrer, age 20, Sarah Glaves, age 36, and Kyle Braun, age 27. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
An ice jam on the Yukon River has raised water levels at Eagle. A few low-lying areas of the Riverside community were reported flooded this morning from the jam about 9 miles downstream. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says conditions are not conducive to serious flooding.
It's been quite warm with above freezing temperatures for the past month, so a lot of the snowpack has melted off, especially all the low elevation snow. So there's no big push of snowmelt coming into the river.
Plum says the water has been slowly rising at Eagle through the day. During an overflight today, the ice jam appeared to have changed very little since Tuesday. Plum doesn't expect the water to go down until the jam releases. He says downriver there's a 12-mile stretch of open water where the Kandick River flows into the Yukon. He adds there is some concern ice could hang up again as the Yukon spreads out and shallows near Circle.
The ice is weaker and thin and rotting, so we're hoping this surge of water just kind of push the ice out past Circle and not be any problems. But we will be flying in the next couple days, monitoring Circle and then also working way down to Fort Yukon.
Plum says this year's breakup is not happening in the more common upriver to downriver pattern, and areas of the lower Yukon are already open. Those who fight to give a second chance to people with a criminal record are being honored today. Only 10 people from across the nation are getting the award. As KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports, one of them is Yupik and Hispanic Alaskan Greg Razzo.
Greg Razzo is in Washington, D.C. to accept a White House Champion of Change Award.
I'm proud to represent our state and Alaska Native people as we strive for equity and justice in the criminal justice system.
Razzo spent almost 20 years in private practice. He's now general counsel for the for-profit Native corporation Cook Inlet Region Incorporated. He says his commitment to equity and justice got its start early in his career when he worked as a state prosecutor in Kodiak.
I've seen prison be a revolving door for very, very many people. I would prosecute some of the same people over and over again for all the time I was a prosecutor. For 3 years, I'd see the same people in and out, in and out.
Razzo is vice chair of the Alaska Native Justice Center and chair of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, which recently issued a report saying Alaska's criminal justice system is costly and ineffective and needs an overhaul. Razzo says the main reasons 2 out of every 3 Alaskan prisoners end up back in prison is the lack of treatment for substance abuse and mental health issues and the need for vocational training.
None of those supports are in place for people coming back into society, reentering society. And it's that reentry function that must start at the very beginning when a person comes into prison. They must begin with a plan that will help them to be successful when they get out of prison.
Razzo says legislation making its way through the state legislature would fix 90% of the problems. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Underage kids caught drinking alcohol won't rack up a permanent charge on their record under a bill that passed the legislature last week. KUCB's Zoe Sobel has more.
Imagine a high school party. All the kids are underage. Some are drinking. When police bust the party, they issue citations, even to kids who haven't had a drop of alcohol. In Alaska, 75% of alcohol-related charges are for minors consuming alcohol. That makes it the number one alcohol charge statewide, affecting about 3,000 young people each year. Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki sponsored Senate Bill 165. He says the punishment can stay with kids forever.
What we were doing before is a misdemeanor criminal offense that went on court view, and it compromised not only their success throughout the rest of high school, but when it became time for scholarships or applying for a job even after coming back from the university, they essentially had a lifelong record.
According to the Justice Center at the University of Alaska Anchorage, the majority of those charged are convicted. Under the new bill, instead of a misdemeanor charge, those under the age of 21 caught drinking will face a $500 fine that could be reduced if they complete an alcohol safety action course. Zara Smelzer runs the Anchorage Juvenile Alcohol Safety Program and works closely with kids charged with MCAs. She thinks the change is important, but wishes the legislation had gone a step further.
I feel like the educational component being mandatory is actually more important than any fine being paid directly to the court, because they're getting the education and treatment to help them make the decision to not do it again until they're of legal age.
Before the bill can become law, it must be signed by Governor Bill Walker. In Anchorage, I'm Zoe Sobel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
What can a tiny piece of dust do to you? It can stop you in your tracks. Studies show exposure to dust pollution can cause tightness in your chest, wheezing, and shortness of breath, even if you're healthy. When you're on an unpaved road, drive slowly, especially when operating an ATV. When hauling dirt, cover it up. Do your part, avoid dust, and clear the air. We'll all breathe easier. This message sponsored by Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
The National Park Service implemented a series of changes at the beginning of this year, which ban various types of predator hunting on Park Service land. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is considering similar changes for refuge lands across Alaska. The agencies say the changes are necessary to better align hunting regulations with federal management objectives. Hunters have countered that there is no biological justification, saying the changes are purely political. KIYU's Tim Bodoni has more.
It's a complicated regulatory situation, but basically the new regulations would prevent subsistence users and sport hunters alike from doing certain kinds of hunting on federal land, things such as taking a brown bear over bait. The fact that subsistence hunters would be affected by the changes is not immediately obvious, because the changes purportedly apply only to what the agencies call non-subsistence take. But what the agencies are referring to with this label is hunting that happens on refuges, parks, or preserves under state regulations where there is no specific federal subsistence hunting season to authorize the hunt. The new federal predator hunting regulations indicate that the state regs can no longer become the default in this way when it comes to what the federal agencies call highly efficient methods and means for hunting bears, wolves, and coyotes. But what if there is a federally authorized subsistence predator hunt in a certain area, as approved by the Federal Subsistence Board? Then the new regulations wouldn't apply, at least for subsistence hunters. Quite by accident, a proposal from Game Management Units 11 and 12 tested that supposition earlier this month at the Federal Subsistence Board meeting in Anchorage. Submitted by the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park Subsistence Resource Commission, the proposal would allow federally qualified subsistence users in the communities surrounding the park and preserve to hunt brown bears over bait in April, May, and June on Park Service land. Wrangell-St. Elias Subsistence Resource Commission member Gloria Stickwan says the proposal was never intended to be a pushback against the new predator hunting rules, but instead to give area black bear hunters some protection.
They instantly took brown bears over black bear bait and it just made it more legal for them to harvest brown bear over bait.
The Federal Subsistence Board passed the proposal, along with 33 others on its consent agenda, without a debate. Commission Chairwoman Karen Linnell wasn't surprised, even with all the controversy swirling around the issue.
Because the regional advisory committees were in support of it. And then that there's really not a conservation concern at this point.
Given that local subsistence hunters account for only a fraction of the brown bear harvest in the Wrangell-St. Elias area, the biological impact of the proposal was found to be minimal. Though the proposal itself didn't cause much of a splash when it passed, its success is encouraging to Jack Rieckhoff, who sits on the commission that helped set subsistence policies for the gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve in and around the Brooks Range.
Gives an indication that the Park Service is willing to work with the subsistence users on addressing methods and means to the benefit of subsistence users.
Further proof of that, Rieckhoff says, is the proposal that came out of his region to allow the use of artificial light when hunting bears at den sites, another practice that's targeted for elimination, with numerous exceptions, under the new predator hunting restrictions. But the Federal Subsistence Board passed that one as well. Rieckhoff is also chairman of the Western Interior Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, which encompasses millions of acres of Fish and Wildlife Service managed land. If the proposed predator hunting restrictions go into effect on refuges later this year, Rieckhoff expects that the Western Interior Council will try to reinstate any number of subsistence predator hunts when the Federal Subsistence Board takes up game proposals again in 2018. Based on what the board did this month, Rieckhoff says that the path forward has become smoother.
The reality is the rural residents can petition the Federal Subsistence Board to continue to allow the methods and means that the state has provided on the refuges.
In Galena, this is Tim Bodoni.
Federal fishery biologists expect only 30 million pink salmon, or humpies, will be harvested in southeast Alaska this season. That's short of last season's 34 million and 2013's record catch of 95 million pinks. KTOO's Matt Miller visited a weir near Juneau that has been recording salmon going out and coming back earlier and earlier for the last 35 years.
Last year's pink salmon runs in southeast Alaska weren't horrible, but they weren't great either. It actually made a big difference where the fish returned in the panhandle.
Northern and southeast turned out good, above average, but southern and southeast just tanked.
Joe Orsi, a research fisheries biologist at National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute in Juneau. Orsi earlier predicted that 54 million pinks would be harvested, but only about 34 million fish were caught, and Orsi concedes he was way off.
As you know, we predicted a fairly good pink salmon return to southeast Alaska, and I kind of have to face the music here, and we didn't get that strong return.
It's still unclear whether a persistent warm water anomaly, nicknamed the Blob, or developing El Nino had any impact on those runs.
Big boy. Big boy, got it.
Hawk Creek is just one example of how some streams in northern southeast had better returns than other streams further south. The Hawk Creek Weir and Hatchery is a small, federally operated facility tucked away in the woods in the 1,500 feet between Hawk Lake and Hawk Bay in Juneau. John Joyce, one of Orsi's colleagues, is a research fisheries biologist also at the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute, and he spends a lot of his time at the Weir. He says local geography and the relatively low drainage area are big factors in the health of the system.
Flow is very important.
A low snowpack in the Hawk Lake drainage melted early in March and April last year. That was followed by a very dry May and then a heavy rain by July.
So all that affects not only the flow in the creek, but also the temperature. And temperature and flow are really important factors for fish that migrate, juveniles and adults.
Joyce uses words like phenomenal and incredible to describe over 24,000 big pinks that returned to Hawk Creek last summer. That's over a 51% marine survival rate for the 47,000 juvenile salmon that passed out of Hawk Creek and into the ocean the previous year. Normal survival rates for returning salmon range from a 0.1% to just 10%, not 51%. The Hawk Creek facility is unique because biologists have data on stream flow and water temperatures that correspond with 35 years of continuously counting salmon. And Joyce says they noticed silver returns have been compressed into a largely two-week period, while pink runs have trended 2 weeks earlier over the last three decades. Joyce says their research into migratory behavior and ocean survival has implications for resource management.
If you have salmon that used to run over a month and you could access them and now they're running over 2 weeks, it affects your ability to harvest, it affects predators' ability to kill, you know, so it does have impacts in terms of ecological impacts in terms of the systems too.
Joyce says they're collaborating with the University of Alaska Southeast, which is using their 35-year data sets in their research to determine how climate change is influencing migratory behavior, marine survival, and productivity. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer, Jacqueline Estes, Zoe Sobel, and Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Bodoni in Galena, and Matt Miller in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska's salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.